Mr. Dobson, Reel 2.
All that are a reaction to enemy activity. As a for example, the second one, a call was received at our headquarters at the police station at the village of Sungai Kob. Was under attack from guerrillas, and the scratch forces hastily put together, and most of the teams are out working on patrol and attacking elements of two platoons, including seven of nine, of them to muster transport and armed to the team who rushed out to Sungai Kob, only to find that there was an ambush waiting in the outskirts of the village and the other plantation and fell under fire and we had to do. Obviously, that triggered off a great deal of patrol activity and chase activity afterwards. Five of our men, including myself, were wounded in this, and I wonder in a minor sort of way with some of the ones who got
seen. Can you tell me in detail exactly what happened?
Oh, yes. Well, we were going out to Sungai Kob, which was perhaps 10 miles away from Kulim. And as we approached the village between banks and the rubber plantation, where the rubber trees are serried ranks of perfectly uniform rows of trees, out from behind the trees popped a gentleman with brown uniform and red crosses on their hats, red emblems on their hats, firing an assortment of weapons at them. Therefore, of course, there were three, as I recall, and they were passing in front of them. We naturally were firing back for all we're worth. And when we got through the ambush, we entered the village itself, we piled out of the vehicle and went back up the road, those of us that could. By this time, we backed off into the jungle. It was, in their terms, an unsuccessful ambush, because their idea would be to stop the vehicles and try and get the weaponry from the people that they'd either killed or injured.
How long did it all last?
Oh. The action itself, we don't really know it as we passed through this particular thing, particular ambush itself, which was perhaps 50, 60 yards of trees with people behind them, and the vehicles kept on going, and we were through and out the other side, and in the village in front of the police station, which hadn't been attacked at all. That was obviously the scrap to catch us.
Where were you hit?
Oh, I was hit in the buttock by a ricochet hit of ordinary gunshot pellets from a shotgun that bounced off the mud guard. I was sitting on the mud guard and I was hit. In fact, the pellets are still there until it went up there.
From a shotgun?
Yes, they carry. They had all sorts of weapons in a shotgun. Shotguns are most common, of course. And, but they also had ball ammunition. One of them had standing right in his back of his thigh, it was still visible, very poor penetration. But other wounds were full ball ammunition from through and through. Half a foot shot of ammo and shot through his body, and did a lot of damage to his spleen and so on. Nobody died. Well, they whisked off to type in a major hospital, and after their own field, we came back.
Do you think the enemy suffered any casualties?
Not in that particular action. It was very wild and hairy. They fired a lot of noise and very little good aim, I think.
Do you think the casualties could have been avoided?
Actually, I don't think we walked into the ambush. They had to say well. The firing of the police station, and we were able to turn out to get there. I think if we'd been a little more circumspect and a little more organized and very well, we could have taken some armored units with us that could have stopped in the ambush and returned fire from within the ambush. But, yes, it could have been better handled, but then all these things came in hindsight, can't they? That's,
I know how to spell Sungai. How do you spell Kob?
K-O-B. It's still there. I did the very long time before I did that 9 years ago. Had a look at the site.
This is a settlement, is it?
It's a village. It's Sungai Kob. Sungai is a Malay word for river. It's Sungai.
Sungai Yus in this case.
Yes.
Any other incidents that you were in that you can recount in which you had contact with the enemy?
I didn't have one other incident of contact with the enemy. And I didn't actually see them. There were no casualties on either side. Again, a lot of noise and confusion. And they were ahead and a lot of shooting. They were trained to do this by Force 136, as I mentioned earlier. Their idea. The idea of Force 136 was to inflict maximum casualty and damage. But unless you had inflicted total casualty and damage, you immediately then ran away to a pre-determined rendezvous, maybe half a mile away, and then flat out for that and regather, and then you can carry on from there. And this is a technique taught to them by, as I say, Force 136, which is very effective. So they would have dashed off through the rubber to a known rendezvous and then regathered and melted away to jungle. Mostly, what they were doing in the aggressive charges out there, apart from the sort of ambush that I have just described, would be to attack the planters in their bungalows out on the estates, or on the roads of the estates themselves, ambush planters, and try and demoralize them into abandoning their rubber estates. And that was a main feature of the economy out there, was the rubber. If they could have ruined the rubber industry, then they would have achieved a lot of other objectives. And so the planters, who were extremely heroic men, and they got their mills and put in a brandy and scotch, were principal targets, or some of the main targets, and lived in hard compounds with police, gunlocks, and...
Did you ever have much contact with the planters as individuals?
Yes, we used to go out and visit the planters to give them, as it were, a relaxing time, because obviously that's an armed personnel carrier, and we ourselves would be armed to the teeth, and we'd go and have a party and supper and some drinks with a planter. Whilst we were there, he would feel safe enough to relax, if he was going to attack an armored vehicle full of extremely loud and determined young men in those circumstances. So yes, we did a certain amount of visiting the planter's estates.
What did you feel about the equipment you had to do the job with?
By and large, it was very good. We had special weapon. It wasn't really hardy weapon. It was weapon made for jungle warfare. We had rifles and boots that were particularly good for jungle warfare. There were canvas boots with rubber soles laced well at the calf. And they let in water very readily. Equally, they dried out again, which try to keep water out of the tin, you're going to be wet the whole time. And that led him to make that mistake. They were laced more or less up to the top of the calf, which kept up quite a lot of the leeches and things that are endemic to the jungle. And I say we had good whipping, we had good rations, the K ration that we had, which we lived off. We were supplied with cigarettes. And now that's not politically correct to smoke, it's a lie to remember an owner's issued cigarettes. Also issued for emergency use with rum, which I had custody of. I certainly got back on boat to camp, but it was worth it for emergencies. On the whole, both now trying to be very quick, considering how recent the war had been. They are badly trained and badly equipped to fight in but I say we had a special rifle, a shortened jungle rifle, which is an Enfield 10 magazine rifle with a flame emulator, flashing emulator on the end of our Bren gun house. Also had Bren guns and Sten guns and Owen guns, which was an Australian version of the Sten gun, much better. And I personally carried an American M2 carbine, largely because it was the lightest thing to carry. And a huge rate of fire, a very high muzzle velocity. It was quite a useless weapon, but it was light to carry. And, as I had other things to carry, like a that place and temples and so on. So I just feel them.
Which weapon did you feel was the most useful against the enemy?
Oh, I think that the 303 rifle was all the brand gun, but obviously only had one brand gun in the platoon, but it's it terrified the bandits to death because it was a very good rate of fire, and the ball itself was a deadly missile. I mean, it hit you in the other arm, not where it hit you. This was 303, the arm as well. Wasn't true of the American carbine, if it goes through someone, you must stop him. We also had a very odd weapon, the grenade launcher, which was the old short Markley Enfield one, the wooden stock that went up to the bell at the very end of the rifle, on the end of which was a cup which held a Mills grenade, and the whole thing was propelled by a ballistite cartridge instead of a round, which fired this grenade 30, 40 yards. The idea being that you couldn't use a 2-inch mortar with its grey shoes in the jungle, it would have run off on the first branch that it contacted having left the mortar, so you hadn't got any mortar weapon as such. And whereas the grenade, which was a time device, 4 or 7 second fuse, was able, so you slip the grenade into the grenade launcher cup, and more usually be carried there with a contraceptive holding it in position, with the pin out, and then when it was fired from the cup, it either flew out from the side, and 3 seconds later, the theory was that it would go off after 7 seconds, whatever fuse was in it was. It would go off, and it didn't matter if it hit something in between time, it wouldn't prematurely explode. So this was a weapon that carried. The only trouble was the grenades were very vulnerable to the damp, and as often as not, didn't go off. That's the Mills grenade, obviously.
What was the morale of the troops like during this, conducting this kind of warfare?
It was very good. It was very good. They, I don't know, it's hard to imagine what their state of mind was. Made it to be good because it was an extremely hard life. But they were keen, for contact with the enemy and to kill the enemy and so on. They were resourceful, they were cheerful, they certainly were extremely hardy in terms of stamina because typically you're going for a 4-day patrol, but you could only carry 3 days' rations, so you have to eat them out on the other day without food. This seems at the bottom, they're extremely fit and mentally hard people. They do very well. I was speaking rather to the National Service as well. Most of them know that. Well, they're good soldiers.
Did most of them come from the Manchester area?
Yes, from Manchester and Liverpool area. Since then, the Manchester Regiment has been merged with the King's Liverpool Regiment and is now known as the King's Regiment. But we've actually recruited from both those cities. And it was a regiment of mixed religion as well, more or less equally divided as Manchester is between the sort of City and United, Anglican and Catholic. And so it was a visit from our own regimental padre, who was Church of England, and from the Roman Catholic padre, who was totally fearless gentleman, read about him. The Britain, Austin, utility, and I'm the blackest, most ambush prone road of all, totally even a little maker, and couldn't say massive canteen and get drunk without the smokers behind and onto his next flock. An excellent man. In fact, the man who was killed, Pat Fitzpatrick, I mentioned in the first patrol, was a Roman Catholic. And a mass was said for him locally by our own Catholic partner. And it was one of the advice, you know, the thing about Roman Catholicism really, but one of the advantages of that religion is that the local community, be they speaking English speaking or not, could join in the Latin mass and did, came along to this this mass that's actually conducted by our own Catholic.
And what were relations like with the local population?
Very good. Obviously, we got on very well with the police because we were working side by side with them. We were also made members of the planters' clubs every weekend, and in the club or in the pool or super there or whatever. Went back there again on my holiday visit to Manchester. And we got on with the local community. I don't know, I remember playing badminton with a Chinese merchant in town. I remember playing so we went out dinner with him, his home, and played badminton on his court afterwards. And he was brilliant, he was fat and middle aged, and he gave us a really good idea in badminton. But yes, they socialising was very.
What do you think the attitude of the local Chinese, Malays and Tamils was to the guerrillas?
I don't know. They, of course, gave the impression that they didn't support them. In the town of Kulim, it's very likely that they didn't support them. The insurrection drew most of its support from peasants who didn't feel anything, of course. Rightly so. And as you probably know, historically, the solution to the insurrection in Tempo's terms was to form camps of rubber tappers behind that wire. They were completely protected, children were educated, sanitation was provided, water, so on. But they were allowed out to do their work. Only there's a minimum amount of food to get. You know, to subsist for the day and go back again. So they cut off the food supply to the local bandits. That was not an operation in Kedah, which is far too rural an area to sort of widespread. So there were farming lands as well as rubber plantations. It was impractical to work that system while you were there. But by and large, there must have been a lobby of support for them because they were good to have ears and the tempo exchanges and so on. So, no, there would be a political background of activists in civilian life who supported them. No, the Communist Party had its followers in the mail. Really emerged as a power since, but no doubt about it at the time.
As you went about off duty, would there be any question of terrorizing troops as there was in places like Nicosia and so on under Ayaka?
No, most of the bandit activity wasn't in towns, it was out in the country, directed against the tappers or against armed drill or police patrols in the countryside, in the rubber plantations or on the roads going between towns. I've not seen any in towns themselves. I mean, our people, our soldiers, went into town. We went into town. When our soldiers went into town, they were unarmed. We went out of the club. We were going to carry sidearms and pistols or something like that because we had to walk back across the golf course to get back from us. By and large, they went unarmed into town and it was cinema or dancing or whatever. The bars. Without any weapons. So, no, they didn't seem to be much of a threat in town. The other recreational facility was, of course, the weekends occasionally on the island of Penang itself, which is off the coast of North Malaya, about 40 miles from Korea. And there was no, whilst I was there, no terrorist activity at all on the island of Penang. The main town of Georgetown was a great international center and recreational nirvana, as it were, everything goes out of all within the point. And that was again free of terrorism, and it was a great weekend retreat, as it were.
Did you ever come across any of the VIPs yourself, like Templar?
No. When I was out there, all work and a little play. I forget how many days I did count how many days I was out there. We landed in Singapore in July of 1951, and I left for England back in April of 1952, so I was only out there for 9 or 10 months. If we say 300 days, I spent 150 of the nights actually sleeping in the jungle, so there wasn't a lot of time, there wasn't a socializing. And the infantry regiments were far flung and didn't have an entity as such. Apart from the biggest social event I went to, I was out there to go and support the returning boxing team in Kuala Lumpur to the support group down there and to cheer them and so on. I don't know about anything I remember.
What was the method of sleeping in the jungle?
Well, you just sleep on the ground, with the ground sheet under you and the ground sheet over you, and 2 weeks you sleep, so right from the side of the line, you sleep in what is called a basha. B-A-S-H-A, which is a bunch of tape on a frame of wooden sticks, which you construct as a lean-to, and my bunch of tape under it is a ground sheet, and sleeping bags on that.
How did you personally cope with the discomforts of the jungle?
The biggest discomfort, apart from the thorns and being stuck into bites, which mosquitoes and things like that, we used to have to take a tablet every day to against a paludan tablet, which is said to be 100% effective, and it was a court martial offence to catch malaria because you hadn't been taking a paludan tablet. And you had to chlorinate the water that you drank, which tasted pretty nasty. But otherwise, no, I mean, it was just because I was young and a bit like gung-ho boy scouting, really.
Apart from mosquitoes, were there any animals which were a threat to you?
No, there were scorpions and there were snakes. But you couldn't really call them a threat. Hornets. They swarmed and attacked me. That was pretty nasty, but I didn't have any instance of that. There were tigers in the jungle. There were certainly elephants in the jungle. I followed their tracks many times. But I never saw one face to face.
Did the enemy ever attempt to attack the camps of the soldiers?
Certainly not our camp, and not any of our camps. They were very lightly guarded. There was obviously a guard post at the gate, and there were barbed wire, and there was a sentry patrol around the camp sort of three times a night basis around the perimeter of the camp. But no, they didn't attack them. There were always dire warnings that they might sneak in and steal weapons, and so if you step on the weapons, you lay them beside your bed, you know. So readily be able to steal weapons. But no, they didn't attack either the fixed camps or certainly in the jungle they didn't attack the temporary bivouac camps, because you're only there from during the night. You settled down to a camp as darkness fell and you left it behind. They took very little initiative except when they were ambushing. If they had the initiative then when they were ambushing, as far as they were ambushed. So in a gurney, they made a good job of that. But otherwise, they only took the initiative in set piece positions like that. They wouldn't go in and make a melee in a camp in the hope of overcoming, let's face it, superior numbers and superior weaponry.
Did you ever capture any of their camps?
No, we didn't capture any of the ground camps. We came across many camps, abandoned them, and some of them used to be abandoned. And the more normal way of coming across their camps would be where one of them defected and came and gave himself up to police, and immediately he was turned around and made to go back where he came from with a patrol behind him, obviously. Well, as part of the patrol to try and see if the camp was still there. So the first thing they did when a fellow defected was to have sticks to move camp, of course, but from time to time, this is a way of contacting them. I'd say that even so, in a pretty ineffective way, because they had guards at these camps, you're unlikely to surprise the camp and overrun it and capture a killer off of them that way. And this is why I think the ambush technique, given the Angrayan, is the means of dealing with it.
What did a guerrilla camp look like?
Well, it was just much the same as ours. Their beds were a bit, obviously, a bit more permanent than ours, and they from saplings and the like. Gurkhas would have made up good beds, or like four-posted beds with mattress of saplings that maybe half a dozen of them would sleep on. Semi-permanent structures, which they left in check when they were young. And bad camps were a bit like that. They sometimes would have weapon caches there, and they'd have fine weapons, but they would have them there. They had some standard issue kit, like the zipper lighter with the big flints and big wicks and petrol, which were really sure when you're getting a fire in the winter. And Gibbs dentifrice toothpaste, as you remember, the solid tablet stuff that you brush through for the long years there, and so on. So, you can find members that learn about the campus. And of course, you can also find the remains of their cooking fires or whatever, which would occur as to how recently they've been there, if they're still warm or whatever. And we had witness, you see. Non-military personnel in the form of one interpreter who could speak several languages, certainly English, obviously, and Malay and Chinese, quite often Tamil as well, and usually two trackers from North Borneo, Iban trackers, very primitive men, extremely gifted trackers, telling you how recently someone had passed, how many of them had passed, a good deal about them. They came over from North Borneo on some sort of contract. They weren't paid, they were equipped and they were fed, and then they were given a shotgun at the end of their stint, which I think was 6 months or something like that. And they were tricked out with the same weapons that we carried, although I think they had been pretty dangerous if they'd started using them. They were invaluable people. They could follow tracks indefinitely.
Did you ever come across the Aboriginal or Sakai population?
No. There were Sakais and another tribe or indigenous population there. And I never came across either of them. They were in very deep jungle, up towards the Thai border mostly. And we were just a little further south than that. I didn't want operation up across the Thai border, but we didn't meet them up there either. No, I didn't meet them.
Doesn't matter what the name is. Did you just operate in the Sungai Kob area?
In the Kunim area, yeah. Well, we had one patrol up in the north-eastern Kela, and across the Thai border. I can't quite remember what it was about, or why we were up there, but we were all blasted up there. Great strength and do a lot of heavy patrolling up there. There's a particularly dangerous road leading up to a town called Crow, K-R-O-H. This road is later famous in the West, which was where the guerrilla leader Chin Peng came out to negotiate with I don't know who on the British and Malay side towards the end of the insurrection. Later disappeared and mysteriously wasn't.